Okay. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, and she gave me her favorite quote, which was told to her by a dear friend, and it's, "You have the right to have people in your life who treat you with love and respect." And with that, we would like to welcome Lenora from Visalia on her 9th birthday.
Hello, my name is Lenora, and I'm an alcoholic. And my birthday is on Earth Day, and how cool is that? I mean, I'm an organic gardener, and my desire is to see the Earth return to its pristine origin, and I'm telling you all that just because it's Earth Day. I'm going to get to my story in a second. With like a group conscience, my story has drugs in it too, and it would be okay if I told my whole story. Okay, thank you. I started out as a teenager drinking on weekends, and what that got me was pregnant. And it was in the 60s, you know, so drugs, sex, and rock and roll was all the thing. And free love was, you know, if it feels good, do it. And I was into it, so I did it. But the casualty of that was that I got volunteered for a home for unwed mothers, and I got labeled some really sweet labels, unwed mother being one of them, unfit mother being another one. My child was a bastard. These are labels that, you know, single women who get pregnant get tagged with. And it only happens in patriarchal societies. I've studied matriarchal societies, and in those societies, every child is a gift from Creator, and the mother is given a sacred gift. So it's a gentler way of perceiving women. But I didn't know that at the time, and I was all immersed in the patriarchal society, and I did my duty and gave up my child, and the birth was horrid, screaming and mean nurses, and they shoved me off to the back end of the hospital and just released me to the back door saying, "Go on with your life," you know, and so I did. I thought I could, and I walked out the door, and I couldn't stop crying. I just, every time I wasn't with somebody, I was crying, until I discovered marijuana, and that was like 3 or 4 months later, and I'm walking down the street, I just smoked a joint, and I'm laughing, and that started my self-medication for emotional health. Life went on. I managed to go through life. I got married. I got divorced before my first anniversary. then I got pregnant again. It was still the 60s, still free love, and I hadn't learned anything, apparently. I couldn't believe it. But this time I said, "I'm not losing this child. There's no way I'm going to let go of this baby." So I moved up to Northern California with my parents and had my little girl, Sophie, and I was immersed. And I, by the way, I got totally clean and sober the whole time I was pregnant. And the whole time I was nursing her was until I stopped nursing her that I moved in with her dad. And we were going to just, you know, together we were going to raise this child. Well, we lived in Felton near Santa Cruz by the covered bridge and met some people who were cruising around the United States in a van and picking apples and making apple pie and selling them out of the back of their truck. Well, they also had some orange sunshine. And oh my God, you know what peaches taste like on orange sunshine? To die for. But I'm not going to romance that. Sorry. But that's just part of my story. So the guys down the street were growing pot, so we had those things. And the winos that lived behind us, you know, kept kicking people out of the house if they didn't stay sober. So half the time they're under the bridge and half the time they're sleeping in the back. So, you know, we passed joints and wine and orange sunshine. Then my baby's daddy said, "How do I even know this is my child?" And so that, you know, set me off, and I was like, "What do you mean? I'm only with you because this is your child, so I'm out of here." So we left. I went back to Eureka and moved into a commune there you know, it was rock and roll all night long and raising my child in this drug, sex, and rock and roll environment. I was all about Adele Davis then because I was organic and I was healing everybody, all these hitchhikers that came through. You know, I always had these magic potions that I could make to make everybody feel better. And it wasn't all drugs, you know, a lot of it was nutritious things. So I was the doctor. But my parents wanted to take my baby. My brother came over and said, "Yeah, Mom and Dad are meeting with the district attorney to have Sophie taken away from you." So I grabbed up my daughter and I ran to Visalia, where my sister and her husband became my best friends. They were like my very, very, very best friends. And once again, I lived in a house on Liberty Street, and all the artists and musicians and freaks and fags and lesbians and, you know, like the whole 60s deal was going on in that house. And my sister is like Christian, Republican, married to a Vietnam veteran. But she's cool with me. She thinks I'm okay, I think. At least that was my impression. But the 60s ended, and in Visalia, it kind of came to a close with a bang. It just disappeared, and it was the 50s again. The 70s were the 50s, and I had all kinds of labels. My baby had a label, and I didn't want that for my child. And my sister and her husband loved my little girl, and she loved them. You know, she had chosen her daddy, my sister's husband, and he made her laugh. So they said they wanted to adopt a little girl, and I thought a big combined family would be ideal. You know, I've got this tribal thing in me, so it sounded like this, we could do this. So I allowed them to, you know, allowed her to have their name so she could go to school. They had two little boys, so it was 6, 4, and Sophie was 2. And she was the star of the family. It was all good. But I'm thinking, okay, she's got this establishment family, so she'll know what all that's about. But she'll still know about, you know, loving the earth and taking care of business on the planet, you know, organic food and all that. You know, that was to bring her closer to the earth, that was going to be my job. That's how I saw it. So after I signed the papers, my sister said, I went and talked to a psychologist, And the psychologist said that the best thing for Sophie would be for you to gradually back out of the picture and, you know, just like see her less and less often and then kind of disappear for a couple of years and then come back into the family. And then once she had adjusted, then it would be okay for you to, you know, take vacations with her and take her and be part of, you know, it could be part of the family again. So I said, you know, if that's what's best for her, that's, you know, that's what I want for all of us, you know. So I filled my end of the deal and I backed off and I went away. And when I came back, I reminded my sister that of our conversation, and she says to me like this: "I don't ever remember having that conversation with you." And I totally freaked out. I realized that I had been scammed, and I was still doing all the things that I needed to keep me emotionally balanced: marijuana, alcohol. But after that little meeting with my sister and her husband, I went to all my family members, and oh my gosh, the words that were coming out of my mouth shouldn't. My mother and father should never hear, you know, the words I was calling them. And I was gracefully proving their case that I was an unfit mother, because who would want a woman to raise a child who spoke that way? So I completely proved their case. But what I didn't know, when I was going to all my family members, what I didn't know was that nobody knew about that child psychologist. In fact, that child psychologist didn't even exist. That was a made-up story to get me out of town. And that what had been told to everybody in my family and my sister's church group and everybody she knew was that I just dumped my baby off and took off. And so when I came back to try to get people to help me get my rightful place in the family back, they treated me like I had just dumped her off and ran off. And I didn't know that they didn't know what I knew. And it didn't come out for years and years later. But what I knew was that they were all in on it. There wasn't one single person who had any compassion for me. And that's when I added cocaine to the mix. I discovered the cocaine grin and the marijuana laughter and the high of alcohol. And I did a line in the morning, and then throughout the day, after my shift at the casino, because I was dealing blackjack and cocaine, everybody wanted it. Then they had free tokens for drinks afterwards, so, you know, I drank anything in a pretty glass. And at the end of the day, I'd smoke a big Sensimilla doobie and put me out. And that was the life that I lived, and I maintained a certain, you know, I went to work every day, I had good credit, I owned my own car, I never ripped anybody off, not even in a drug deal. I was like this really good person, except I was a drug addict, an unwed mother, an unfit mother, you know, all those things. And every time I'd show up in the establishment, I just looked like, you know, something out of a sci-fi movie or something, because Visalia just was, I don't know, 10 years behind the times or something. And at least I think I was affected a great deal by the 60s. I realized that the government had lied to me, and that they told me that I could give up my child and go on with my life as if this had never happened. Well, that was a lie. And I didn't hear from my church until 4 months after I had given up my child. And then they sent me a letter, and they wanted me to tithe. And so I was kind of not too happy about their participation in my life. I've been in that church since the day I was born. So I kind of, you know, let go of that. So anyway, you get the picture. I felt like I had been betrayed and run over by everybody I knew, and then I walked into this, you know, I'm in the drug and alcohol and casino environment, and if you put your arm around somebody and your hand in their pocket and you walk away, you've got all their money and they're still smiling, you did something good that in a casino. And so it's a really cutthroat, you know, get it while you can kind of environment, and that kind of eroded me until I couldn't really recognize who I was, and I wanted out. So my answer for that was to go raise marijuana in the Trinity Alps, you know, back to nature. And when I went to the Trinity Alps, all the Vietnam veterans and the hippies were still hiding out in the woods. It was kind of a weird combination. And it was a little crazy, too. When Ronald Reagan sent the helicopters in and ran, you know, the guys in the little blue suits zipped up the front with big black boots and an automatic weapon hung over the back, came down ladders out of the helicopters and chased you down in the woods. The sheriffs used to not do that. They just came in, got the marijuana, went out, dried it, bought an airplane. You know, they were in on it and they didn't care. But, you know, these feds, a whole different story. It was not fun anymore. So out of the woods I went to go 10 bar. And then my drinking really took off because, you know, everybody's buying the bartender shots. But I went from there, I left the woods and went to join the Carpenters Union, because I've been running around the woods for 6 years, so I was really strong, so I could work construction and not a problem. And by this time, my little girl's 16 years old, and she wants me to come back to Visalia, and I am just a drunk, stoned, drug addict. I mean, I couldn't quit if I wanted to at that point. And I realized it was getting in the way of all my relationships. I couldn't, when I got a house in Visalia and my little girl was standing outside the door and knocking on the door, and I was too drunk to answer the door. You know, I had waited for 14 years for her to be in my life again, and I was too drunk to answer the door. And it's not, I wasn't done. It was 2 years later before I checked myself into a rehab hospital and went to my first AA meeting. And I didn't know they were going to send me to an AA meeting at the rehab hospital. They said, do you want to go to a meeting? Well, I've been 3 days in detox, so I was like, yeah, anything, get out of here. So I went to this meeting. There was like this table of people, maybe 10 people at the table, and the first guy says, I don't know what his name was, I'm just going to say Brian. He says, my name's Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just practically bonked my head on the table just thinking, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed for you. But by the time it went around the whole table and all 10 people had told their story, and some of them said, I'm an addict, some of them said, I'm an alcoholic, some of them said, I'm an addict alcoholic, and by the time it got to me, the 10th person around the table, I introduced myself as, My name is Lenora, and I'm an addict alcoholic. And that was my introduction to AA. And in that program, they had you work the first 5 steps in 28 days before you could leave. And I saw the power of these steps. You know, I spent 28 days doing nothing but writing and participating in meetings that where we were working the steps. And I found out things about myself and my actions and my addictions. And it was an amazing transformation, and I couldn't believe that just these steps could have so much impact, make so much difference. And I thought, you know, because I decided that only 10% of the people in the rehab hospital were going to make it, well, I was going to be one of those 10%. And I stayed sober for 13 years. And I went to college, and I graduated summa cum laude, Phi Kappa Phi. I had an organic garden. I got my little farm. My grandchildren were being born, and my daughters came back to me. I was in heaven, but my husband and I were not working any program. We just quit. I went to that five, you know, did the 5 steps at the rehab hospital, but I didn't, and I just went once a year to pick up my next chip, and I got 10 chips, you know. I could shake up a little tambourine with my chips I had collected, but I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a home group. I didn't read the big book. I didn't do any of those things. But my life was I was like on this amazing pink cloud high until my husband and I started going around, and all of that education and all of that, everything that I had learned didn't make any difference at all when my personal relationship went bad. My best idea was to get Sensimilla and Budweiser and fix my husband with it. 3 years later, we were divorced. Didn't work. And I was back in AA because I knew where to go if I needed to quit. And this time I read the big book, I got a sponsor, got a home group, and I started learning some things about how to manage my life without making trades, you know, because my 10-year program was I'm going to still do everything addictively because it just wasn't acceptable for me not to get 100% on a test or at least between 95 and 100. So I did that addictively. I didn't have one single weed in my organic garden or anywhere in my yard. There was, you know, that was not allowed in my place. I was diligent about everything, but I was just going to replace all the destructive addictions with constructive addictions. That was my program. Well, obviously it didn't work in my personal relationships, and that's, you know, that's what I learned is that's where it really shows up. Whether if you're working your program, your personal relationships should be getting better. And when I started back to meetings, this woman said to me, "You have the right to have people in your life who treat you with love and respect." Well, I was still trying to get along with all these people who thought I had dumped off my child and that kind of thing. And nobody wanted to hear that it was any different than that. So I couldn't really go back and tell them, well, 14 years ago, you know what really happened? Because she is like the establishment lady. They're not going to believe me over her. So I just had to live with what they thought about me. And I spent a lot of time in my head trying to fix that. What I found out in AA was that what other people think about me is none of my business. They can think anything. They can say anything. If it's not true, I don't need to be there. I know who I am, and what goes on inside of me is my only business. What goes on inside of my head, what I think about, is my only business. And until I can find peace inside my own head and have a conversation with my Creator that is peaceful, generous, beautiful, loving, kind, and in constant gratitude, when I have that kind of conversation with my Creator. And then the next step was I needed to have that same conversation with my own physical body. I needed to be kind, generous, and in gratitude to my own physical body. And I carry that one step further. I have that same kind of conversation with the earth. I like to do the, you know, earthing, they call it, where you go barefoot on the earth and it's all, you're absorbing all these wonderful vibrations from the earth. But when my conversation starts to shy away from being in gratitude with my Creator and being in gratitude with my physical body, it's because I'm trying to control something that is outside of my control. I'm trying to control you, what you think, what you feel, what you do, instead of just being still with myself until I get a divine inspiration. And it always comes. You know, the promises say that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And I've come to, Bill W. says, and I have experienced it myself, I have come to rely on it. When I don't know what to do, I just get still. I go to that place within me that is perfect peace. And I've found it. I know it's there. I know how to get there. And the way I get there is through the serenity prayer, through steps 1, 2, and 3. Just let it go. Let it go. I can't control it. Let it go. And when I'm able to let it go, then I can find that place of peace within myself. And the longer I stay there, in the beginning, I was told it doesn't matter how long you stay there. It could be 2 seconds. It only matters that you continue to go there. How many times a day do you go there? And you practice and you practice and you let it go and you go back there. You blow yourself out. You know, the first time I really experienced that place of peace within and felt completely relaxed, it lasted about 3 seconds because my committee came in and started saying, "You are so lazy and irresponsible. You're not doing anything." But I came to realize there's nothing more powerful than to be in that place. Because when I get there, everything else falls into place. And if I stay there until I know exactly what to do, beyond a shadow of a doubt, because I get an inspiration that says, this is what you have to do. And all the information that I need to accomplish that comes with it. And it happens every time. I'm not wasting my time by sitting still. It's the most powerful thing that I can do. And while I'm sitting still, I'm in gratitude. And if it takes a couple of days, I start taking care of my body. You know, I take a shower, brush my teeth, to get some rest, go to the gym, whatever it takes. But I stay in that place of gratitude, and I wait to know what the right thing to do is. Well, I learned how to forgive. Through this program, I learned how to forgive. It doesn't matter what anybody ever did to me. That's water under the bridge. It matters what I do today. And there's a a little story that someone told me about this little spirit that goes to Creator and says, I don't know what perfection is. I want to feel perfection. And Creator says, well, what kind of perfection do you want to feel? Because there's all kinds. You could feel perfection of gratitude or compassion or forgiveness. And the little spirit says, I want to know the perfection of forgiveness. Creator says, well, you have to go into the physical world and become dense, and someone has to agree to become more dense than you and do something to you that is unforgivable. And when you learn to forgive them, you will know the perfection of forgiveness. And but Creator warned, once they have done this thing for you, you must go and remind them of who they are. And so the two little spirits went down, and that was me and my sister. And I've done my part to remind her of who she is. She hasn't, you know, she's still maintaining the whole thing was, well, her attitude about it is, the end justifies the means. So that's where that's still at. But that's none of my business. That's her journey. And I've learned in this program that you get to have your journey, and I get to let you. Because we all came here with the purpose. This is just my opinion that I've come up with for my own inner being. We come here with the purpose of spiritual expansion. And we call to ourselves that which we need in order for us to achieve the best spiritual expansion we can while we are in this lifetime journey. And I agreed to do all of these things. I created them on the way. I came into this program a victim. You know, it's everybody else's fault, and if everybody hadn't been so mean to me, I never would have done what I did. But the truth is, I participated 100%. I chose the people. I chose the substance. I chose the jobs. I did it. I created it. I am powerful enough to create that big of a disaster. But I'm also powerful enough to create a life I want to live. And I'm learning how to do that. I'm learning how to do that by letting you have your journey. I'm okay if you want to do whatever it is. If you need to relapse to, you know, you think you need a little more suffering before you can expand, that's your thing. It's okay. I mean, I don't want you to, but I don't get to choose. I can't keep anybody sober, and I can't make anybody go out there. I don't have that kind of power. I can keep me sober. I can keep me sober by every day when I get up. I make sure that my head's in the right place before my feet hit the floor. I get myself right. I know how to get myself right. I turn over whatever rotten thing was in my head when I woke up, if there was one. Sometimes there's not one. Hooray for that day. But if there is, I wake up and I'm, you know, having a crappy thought about something. I don't get out of bed until that's gone. And I turn that over and I find that place of peace, and I begin to be grateful about what is in my life. You know, I did get my children back. I do have 7 little people that call me grandma. And that was unexpected. Those are gifts, amazing gifts. And I also got to be there. You know, when I was a little girl, my daddy was so interested in his sons that he never looked at me. In fact, I was a big embarrassment to him because I was trying to be his best son. And when I would outshoot or outride or whatever, his sons, it hurt his feelings, and he was, you know, anyway, that whole deal. So all I wanted from him was for him to hold my hand and smile at me. And that never happened when I was growing up. But you know what? When my daddy turned 90, he started getting into some failing physical places. And he told me, if I have to go into the hospital, would you come and sit beside my bed and hold my hand? And I got to hold my daddy's hand while he smiled at me on his way out of the physical world. The last thing that happened before my dad left this physical world was that he clasped my hand in both of his hands. He'd had a stroke, so he couldn't talk, but I could see how much love there was in his eyes. And I stood there and held his hand, and then I put my arms around him and I said, I love you very much, Daddy. And that was the last time I saw my daddy. And when I went to see him, it was like he had passed on for about 5 minutes. When I walked into that room, it was like he had left the physical world, but he left the door open to the spirit world. And that energy poured into that room, and there was so much peace and love and joy in that room that my mom and I just stood there. We couldn't believe it. And we talked to my dad there like he was still in the room. And I said, Mom, I don't think he's gone that far yet. And when we left and went and got in the car, we were just amazed that we didn't feel that tremendous loss. What we felt was, my mom said to me, you ask your dad to give you, you know, to let you know if he could, to let you know he was all right. I think he let you know he was all right. And I gotta say, I could never have had that experience, a healing experience for me, if I hadn't been in this program, if I hadn't gotten a sponsor, gotten a home group, read the big book, paid attention to what's going on inside of me, been loving, kind, and generous, and compassionate, where I wasn't before. If I hadn't done all those things and been in this program where I learned those things, my spiritual expansion began here. But, you know, it's gone on so much farther. I now build earth domes. And look it up on Google, you know, Google earth domes, and you'll see what it is. But they last as long as the pyramids, and they look beautiful, just, you know, electricity, water. I mean, it's a good thing. So and that wouldn't have been possible if I had still, you know, been pursuing trying to control other people. Now I'm trying to control the whole planet. But I'm turning it over and just taking care of what's going on inside of here. I'm holding vision for a planet returned to its pristine origin. I want to be able to drink from the rivers. I hope you're with me on that one. And that's all I got for today.